Tam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghuratam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Continuing questions. Many of these are about Varnashram and its interaction with the practice of bhakti. And about these questions in general, I would say if we understand the principles, then the details become easier to understand. I think, better close the door. Tamil pop music we're not so fond of. The basic principle is that life is meant for service to Krishna, full surrender to Krishna. People are on different levels. There are people who want to surrender to Krishna, but they still have various material attachments, desires, impurities, so they should follow Varnashram as long as they are not fully free from all material desires. Those who are fully free from material desires and are pure devotees in the fullest sense of the term, they may also follow, to set an example for others. And others who are not in Krishna consciousness, they should also follow. They need to follow more than anyone. But to what extent one follows, that will vary from individual to individual, from community to community. That's why well, like I said, just like, for instance, in each sampradaya, usually the acharya himself gives a set of rules particular to that sampradaya. Madhvacharya wrote his Sadacha Smriti, I believe it's called. Then we have in our sampradaya the Hari Bhakti Vilas, Shadkriya Shadipriya, and actually Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu gives so many rules of what to do. And of course, many things are not there, many of the things are not even stated, because they're just so much part of the culture that you, just like in Hari Bhakti Vilas, there's no direction on how to perform Archanam. It doesn't mean that there's no Archanam performed, but it's just understood, I suppose. It's so much part of the culture. We also won't find in our Vaishnav Smriti, as I said, there's Smriti for different communities. The heads of that community, they will select from Shastra certain usages or rules which are suitable for that community. But everything may not be there. How many things can you put in there? Respect the cows and respect the elders. That may not be there. But it doesn't mean that we don't do it, but it's so much part of the culture. It doesn't need to be explained further. But we're in a different situation, especially coming from the Western world, where we don't have that. Hare Krishna. Although it is, certainly we'll find that repeatedly definitely in Mahabharata, Ramayana, it all teaches, for instance, how to respect elders. In Srimad Bhagavatam, it's just based on that culture, it's just so much part of the culture that it may not need describing in detail in every smriti. Smriti here I'm referring to guidebooks compiled for particular communities. In Smartas they have also this Raghunandan Smriti, is famous in Bengal, which is written in opposition to the Haribhakti Vilas, it's presumed. Very influential up to the present day. People still follow many of the things in that. Just like Harinama Ananda, one of my disciples, his father just died, so he was asking about the rules traditionally in most of India, people they stop doing puja and they just eat very plain food and all these kind of things. But in the Vaishnava society, we don't stop doing puja. Take an insurance policy. Well, I already spoke about that, right? Prabhupada wasn't against that. Arrangement for future security and rather depend on Krishna. Yeah, well, I already spoke about that, didn't I? Sarvarogo Pashaman, Brihad Vishnu Purana. How's that? Is it Sarvarogo Pashamam? Is it Sarva Padrava Nashanam? Shantidang Savarishtanam? Harinamanukevalam? Kirtanam. Constant chanting of Harinam is extremely beneficial and auspicious. Doesn't say that in the Sanskrit. Because it destroys all diseases, distresses, and Sarvarogo Pashamam. Upashamam means gives relief from, as far as I know. I have a Sanskrit dictionary. That's how it's Prabhupada translated that. In the Bhagavatam, that Bhakti Yoga Vidhanatam, not that verse, Anartho Pashamam Sakshad Bhakti Yoga Madhokshaje Lokasya Janato Vidvans Chakre Sadvata Sanghitam. So that gives a sense of giving relief from. Sarv Upadrava, it destroys all disturbances. Shantidam, gives shanti. Savarishtanam. Arishta means inauspicious things. Harinama Nukirtanam. Yeah, so what about that? What's the question concerning that? Does it not call in people the mentality of the eighth offense against the holy name? Well, it may be the way that you take it. That might be good for people at a certain level to tell them that. We don't preach that. We don't go around preaching chant Hare Krishna and get free from diseases and this and that. It's a secondary, it's a byproduct. So it's stated in Shastra repeatedly that the holy name it gives all material benefits also. Right in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, do yajna and you'll get this, all the desired. What is that verse from Bhagavad Gita? That, Devan Bhavyatanena. See, we're all downheaded here. Let's have a look at that. At the beginning of chapter 3. Is it? Yes. Devan bhavayata anena te deva bhavayantu vaha parasparam bhavayantaha shreya param avapsyata. The demigods being pleased by sacrifice will also please you, and thus by cooperation between men and demigods, prosperity will reign for all. Reign, R-E-I-G-N. So Harinama is the yagya. When Srila Prabhupada went to Hyderabad, they had a severe drought there for 2 years. And when he arrived, they a reporter asked Prabhupada, are you a Dvaitavadi or an Advaitavadi? And Prabhupada said, what's the use of this question? There's no rain, there's no water. You have to perform yajna. He said, we will perform yajna, Harinam yajna. So devotees, they went out in the city and did Harinam. Within 2 days, there was profuse rain. So, there was drought in Gujarat. I suggest, why don't we go and do Harinam Yajna? Because they were doing all these Gayatri Parivar Yajnas. And the devotees said, what if it doesn't work? I don't know. In Hyderabad also, when the devotees were asking Prabhupada about digging wells, Prabhupada said, you do kirtan, rain will come. You'll get sufficient rain. So, we have also there in Bhagavatam, Sarva Swato Palabhyate, that all swart, all desirable objects come from Sankirtan. That verse is there, this Taling Sabhajyantyaya Gunagya. Sara Bhagina Yatra Sankirtana Neva Sarva Swartopalabhyate. People who are Gunagya, they know the quality. They worship Kali Yuga. Because in Kali Yuga, simply by Sankirtan, everything desirable is attained. So it's right there in Bhagavatam. Now, at the same time, there is the eighth offense, to consider the chanting of Hare Krishna to be like performing mundane yajnas. So we should understand this is a byproduct. Those who are chanting Hare Krishna, they don't do so in the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Sampradaya. They don't do so for material gain. But it is a byproduct. The Shastra says repeatedly. For those who are on the path of pure devotional service, it may not come, and they may not want it to come, all desirable things. It's just like people pray to Ganesh to remove all obstacles, but then we're studying Srimad Bhagavatam, Kunti Devi is asking, please give me more obstacles. So we have a completely different outlook. You'll say, why don't you worship Ganesh? Well, we want obstacles. And they can't work it out at all. Obstacles on the path of material progress. Oh, there's an interesting point also, that in one of his letters, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said that it's certainly acceptable, I can't remember the exact word he used, to petition Rishimha for bodily health so that one can perform devotional service. Somehow or other, in that big book, that Prabhupada Saraswati Thakur, they said Ganesh. It's in the Patravali, in the collection of his letters. Exactly the wording, I can't remember, but he was answering a question, obviously, in a letter, and he said it's certainly acceptable or glorious or something like that to worship or to petition Nrisimhadev for good health for performing devotional service. But somehow, that's quoted in that book, Prabhupada, that big book, Prabhupada Saraswati Thakur, and somehow they put Ganesh in there. I don't. But then I was reading it in the original. It's in Nrisimha. Why they put Ganesh? I have no idea. Maybe the typesetter was a karmi. Or... funny, you know, that could throw people out their whole devotional life just by changing that one word. They say that? There's so many things. You just can't keep up with them. You can't keep up with all the things. That's why, actually, in any sampradaya, they'll tell you, you just go to one path and stick to it. Because if you just go out fishing in the big ocean of mental speculation, there's no end to it. You have to take a guide and follow. So, I'm doing that for most of you here. I mean, if you just want to decide everything by yourself, and there's no end to it. There's just no end. There's so many. If you just go on the internet, and even within our ISKCON, there's so many different opinions. And that's only, I mean, in terms of the number of people and ideas in the world, it's just a tiny drop. And then you go to the broader world of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, the broader world of Vaishnavism, of all different Vaishnava sampradayas. You know, Madhva said this, and then Vedanta Deshika said this, and then you go to broader Vedic culture, Hindu culture, and then everything else. There's no end. So we have to find a guide and follow. Otherwise, there's no end. This buffet system of devotional service, it doesn't work. You get indigestion. Choose your own. Take what you like. Take a little bit here, a little bit there, mix it all up. It's just like making a bomb at home. You want to blow something up, you blow yourself up. You kill yourself. That happens, doesn't it? The people, they're making a bomb to blow something else up, and they end up blowing themselves up. So, so many people are getting, they may be misled by this wrong information, but they're being misled by so many things. It's just, there's no end to it all. Ashesha klesha, just unlimited. So many. So many funny ideas. So, what are we talking about anyway? Will this mislead people? It can do. It can do, but that's why you have to have it explained. Another point is that in the modern age we have the reading culture, and Srila Prabhupada, he did stress that a lot. People should read his books. But the traditional culture is the hearing culture. And books are written, traditionally they're written as guides to the guides. Just like the Goswamis were writing their books. In that generation, how many people read? It's not like they print a million copies of the Bhakti Sandarbha distributed. There's no question of printing. There was no handwritten. And after writing, he taught what we know, 3 students. And then they went and taught their students. And then they have from Srinivas Narottam and Shyamananda. There's so many devotees. But it's not that everyone studied the Sandarbhas. They're guides. Even the commentaries, you find the Vaishnava, they're usually not very extensive. Just a few words. But then they're supposed to be taught to the disciple, who then explains to his disciple like this. So the books, the books are supposed to be here. Or here, in the heart. The culture of printed books has changed the whole attitude toward books. There's so much information, and then we're trying to get more and more information and show how much we know and all this kind of thing. But traditionally, just like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, bahu granta na paribhe, don't study many books. Concentrate. You have Srimad Bhagavatam, just a few study and know it very well. And in the modern culture, we have the idea that, well, you read this book, you read that, you give some idea, but Shastra Chakshur, see through the eye of Shastra. It's not, you read it, and then everything you learned up to that, and then you, up to that point, you bring all your mental faculties to try to understand it. That's not the way Shastra is to be understood. We don't apply everything we learn to understand Shastra, but we think through the Shastra. That scholar picked up that point. That our whole mental process is shaped by the Shastra. It's not that, well, we have to consider this in terms of some, you know, modern rational thinking and be nice to everyone and deconstructionism. Madness. It's not that we should apply our materialistic way of thinking, however much we may think it is highly advanced, the academic way of thinking, in which we approach it neutrally, which is completely bogus. There's no such thing as approaching anything neutrally. And we examine the idea which we hear Shastra and imbibe that from the association of people who are living Shastra. And this becomes our apparatus for viewing the whole world. Not that the world becomes our apparatus for viewing the Shastra. So we be, just like Srila Prabhupada said, we should make Srimad Bhagavatam our life. So it's the whole way of thinking should be shaped by Shastra. Guru Mukha Padma Vakya Chite Te Koriya Aike Ana Kori Homane Asha. So how are we to understand this? How are we to understand this? Through the teachings of the Acharyas. None of them ever promoted this. You do Harinam for some material gain. That is there. In Bangladesh once I was, it was the first summer I was there, and it was the hottest summer in 40 years, extremely hot. It was a long summer, the rain didn't come till very late. And out in the villages, no electricity. So it was a new experience for me. So some Harinam was organized, and we went from the ponds were dry. So people were suffering. There's no water. They had to go a long distance to get any water. So anyway, we were going in the village all morning, going around doing Harinam, and at each house they'd throw some water wherever they got the water from, and the kids would all roll in that and get all muddy. We went all around in the pile. And later on I found out that this was a village system of invoking rain. When there's no rain, is what you do. So, I didn't know. I thought it was nicer organizing Harinam in the village. But it was organized for the sake of rain. So in one sense it's nice. They have faith in the holy name. But it would be better if they did Harinam regularly. Actually they did also. They regularly perform Harinam. But again, it depends on the motives. And it depends a lot on our association, on how our motives form, and ourselves also. But that's why people say I'm extreme and all this. I'm too extreme. But the thing is, once you start bringing in this, all right, now we'll have... We'll practice bhakti for personality development, or we'll practice it all the harinams and everything nowadays you do for world peace, which is extremely vague. But then you just get the, if we're always talking about harinam for world peace, and then for harmony and just, you know, completely vague terms. And then we start thinking that, and then we give a public speech, we're doing this for world peace. And then we start thinking like that. So we should always preach that we are here to serve Krishna without any personal motivation. That is the only that's the only actual benefit for everyone. Everything in this material world is temporary, miserable, and unsatisfying. If we preach like that, then we'll keep on course. But if we start saying, well, more people can relate to it, if we say that we're doing Harinam for world peace, for harmony, auspiciousness, and more people can relate to it, and then more people will chant Hare Krishna. That's probably true. That, well, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, because it's extremely vague. Everyone does everything for peace, right? All these religious groups. But the people can feel more comfortable and relate to it. Yeah, but they may chant Hare Krishna, but not for the purpose that we're supposed to be chanting. Actually, the purpose is just to satisfy Krishna. So many people will chant, maybe. I'm also not sure if it increases the number of people chanting. People don't have to think about it much. They don't feel threatened by it. But their chanting from the beginning comes with the wrong motive, or not the motive that's going to... The actual benefit of chanting doesn't come from that. So from the beginning we get off on the wrong foot. So these statements are there in Shastra, but at the same time it's not promoted by our acharyas that we chant Hare Krishna to get material benefits. That may be there. We should expect that in a society where people are Krishna conscious, that it won't be disturbed as the modern society. So disturbances come from lust, greed, anger. So in a Krishna conscious society, these disturbances should not be there. This society of devotees where there's a strong motive to please Krishna, then it should be like the time of Maharaj Yudhishthira or Rama. So that should be expected. That even for material well-being, if we chant Hare Krishna, that will be very beneficial for us. And even apart from chanting, the lifestyle that Prabhupada recommended, that will be very healthy for us, physically and mentally, just living a natural life. The modern life is physically and mentally very bad for physical health and mental health. So Prabhupada would also say that. If you live simply, chant Hare Krishna, then the society will become peaceful. And the problems will be... Prabhupada was very concerned to solve the problems of the world. He was this-worldly and other-worldly. Those two terms are there. This-worldly means people are concerned with this world and other world. He was also concerned with people's problems in this world, and he wanted to present Krishna consciousness as a practical program for solving the problems of modern society. He was very concerned with that. So yeah, we can preach like that. That if you chant Hare Krishna, you're in easy journey to other planets. He says that they'll make better citizens of the state if people are devotees. So we can present it like that also. But it shouldn't be the main or the only thrust of our preaching. And especially among devotees, we should always be very clear about what is devotional service. Srila Prabhupada envisioned that those who come in to the, and very close They will be brahmanas who will lead this society. They will be absorbed in shastra, absorbed in bhakti. And as I understand it, he didn't expect everyone to be on that level, but there should be a core of brahmanas to lead this society. Real brahmanas who know shastra, who live according to shastra. So, Srila Prabhupada's vision, how that will be enacted, it may be very different from the 1960s or 1970s ISKCON in many ways. Just like we were discussing, that yagyas, performing yagyas, and then we get, now we have devotees doing pujas for people's new motorbikes and cars, and how far do you go? Well, if they don't come to us, they'll go to someone else. We can do it with take your motorbike with Krishna's blessings. I mean, we do that, right? With clothes, we offer that to Krishna. The idea, you should offer whatever you use, you offer it to Krishna. So the idea that, well, you offer this motorbike or you take the blessings from God, well, better they take blessings from Krishna than from Sai Baba or whatever. So that may be there. So that may seem to add a, if we do that, that was, may seem to add a karmic influence to our movement. It may very well be there also. How to balance that? Well, the preachers and teachers have to be pure devotees and always preaching to keep everything in proper focus. That, all right, we'll perform rituals for someone's baby or whatever. But Hari Seva Anukulaiva, everything should be done for the sake of Hari Seva. It is a very delicate point because the tendency of materialistic people to convert the language and the activities of bhakti into activities of sense gratification is that's the whole story of the material world. That's the whole story of religion. As Srila Prabhupada said, Jesus, he didn't come to teach this eating and sleeping business. But they converted Jesus into a meat eater and a drunkard. He wasn't a meat eater or a drunkard, it seems from research. But they made him into a drunkard. They redefined him as a drunkard so they could all be drunkards. So that tendency is there. Now we have, as Jayadeva Swami pointed out a few years ago, that there's been the all-merciful Prabhupada, just like Jesus. That you just believe in Jesus and you do whatever you like and Jesus will forgive you. But Prabhupada himself, he never said that. He never said, well, you do whatever you like and I'll forgive you. You just believe in me, some vague statement. But he pointed out that the Christians are hypocritical because they don't follow Jesus, what he said. But it's been converted from Christianity. They've made Prabhupada into the new Jesus, some people. You just believe in him and pray to him and love him and Prabhupada will save you. You don't have to follow anything. You just believe in him, that's all. And you'll find that the whole generation of, in the West especially, many of the young people who grew up in devotee families, they have this understanding of Prabhupada. They don't have any guru or need any guru because they know Prabhupada since childhood and they just believe in Prabhupada. And they don't follow anything, but they just... It's Ritvikish idea, but then they're not even that serious to take even a Ritvik initiation. So it's just the idea that, you know, Prabhupada is just, he loves me. And therefore, he understands me. That I really love Krishna. I don't have to follow all these things because I just love Prabhupada and I love Krishna. So these things, you have to be very careful. So, such statements can be interpreted like that, and that that chanting Hare Krishna will relieve all distress and you'll get good health. It can be misinterpreted, and that's again why we need acharyas who live and speak according to the actual teachings of Rupa Goswami. And we can expect that as Krishna consciousness is spread more widely, that more and more people will adopt the sahajiya mode and the karmic mode. Maybe not exactly in the Hindu way, but maybe mixed with their own culture. It's practically inevitable. That's why we have to keep on speaking the right thing. Otherwise, within our own ISKCON, we get supposed to be spiritual leaders teaching that, well, the most important thing is you have to smile. You told me that? At a seminar, one of our leaders, the most important thing is that you always have to smile. And we see that also. In Russia once, I saw there was a picture of a lotus petal, drawing of a lotus petal. On each petal was a picture of one of the ISKCON gurus who was regularly visiting Russia. My picture wasn't there. And every picture was of them smiling. Like the main duty of a guru is to smile. Seems that that's the idea. Smiles, blesses you, and then you feel, that's it. So, okay. What's the next question? Can it encourage this misunderstanding? If it's taken wrongly, yeah. It's not untrue that Hainam is the best medicine, it's the best for everything material. It's not untrue. We shouldn't want to edit it from Shastra. But how it's understood, we have to understand it in context of the fuller picture. That's why it's very good to distribute this. Prabhupada's books, this Prahlad Maharaj, Transcendental Teachings of Prahlad Maharaj. Very good. Just like a little bomb for destroying any hopes of material happiness. Who told me that? Someone? Guru Das, was it? He told me that he went in a shop and showed someone a book, and he opened up Prahlad Maharaj, Transcendental Teachings, and read it a little bit and gave it back and said he didn't want any of the books. So who told me that? Madhukanta told me that. So what does that mean? We shouldn't distribute books like that. That means we should distribute books like that. Unfortunately, he didn't take it, but others will take it, and it'll reach the right person at the right time. Anyone who reads it, they're going to be shocked, because you can go in Chennai or Bangalore, go and look in all the bookshops, even the religious bookshops. You won't find anything like that. Just a complete exposure of the miseries of material life and how material attachment is the cause of bondage and suffering. Just brutal to the materialist. They should hear this. And they should hear it with the proper conclusion also, that we have to surrender to Krishna. So that small book is like a little, not even a book, it's a booklet. It's a very potent bomb, which that people don't like to hear it is the reason that it should be spoken and distributed. Otherwise, if we just speak what people like to hear, it just becomes useless. This essay I'm working on, just going on and on working on, speaking strongly in Prabhupada's service. And practically all the time I've been out there, I've been working on this. Still didn't get it right. Because I went through it. I thought I'd finished it, and I thought I'll give it a final read, and I find there's so many repetitions. So I'm just completely reworking the whole thing. But it's necessary. Why we have to speak strongly. We have to see also how to who as I'm told by Mahatattva Prabhu in America now, especially where he is in Southern California, the present generation, they're all like what's that word, scarred or what's that word? Where you have some bad experience, and then I just can't remember the word now. Scarred, sky. They're traumatized by organized religions, where this Christian fundamentalist preaching. So they don't want to hear the word God. They don't hear the word preach, Lord. What do you say to them? You pretend you're a Buddhist or what? But he has a whole strategy that you bring people in, you speak no more than 15 minutes in a general way. Have blissful kirtan, give them prasadam and speak with them individually. Not in the temple room, in a little room at the side. And then the success is if they come another time. But he said it's the kirtan, the power of the kirtan. People go to all these different yoga groups and Buddhist groups, but they don't have anything like our kirtan. Even they may have this rascal's kirtans, but it doesn't have the spiritual shakti. So if you can get them to come again, if they come a third time, then you invite them to the temple. Otherwise you don't invite them to the temple. In the temple you speak whatever you want to speak. So, then it may not be that we always, the first time that we meet people, that we tell them straight out that material life is totally miserable. We may do. It depends. We have to see. Preaching is also an art. But we shouldn't avoid saying that. It's not that under any circumstances we should never say this. Rather, we should say it. But how and to who? Just like you told me in Croatia, you met people, rich people from Zagreb on holiday. And at first you were just like joking with them and this and that. Then after a few minutes you said something, they asked you something about philosophy. And you said, well, actually, material life is miserable. And then, after you'd made a little rapport with them, then they, oh yeah, actually it's true. Then they were ready to hear it. It's not that you didn't say it, but it's not like the first thing you said to them. First a little rapport, a little speaking with them like that. So we have to see. There's, as I mentioned in that book, you can't tell. When you speak the truth, some people may get angry, some people may be turned off, some people may transform their life, and they'll just take up Krishna consciousness. I gave a quote from an essay from Ravindra Swarup Prabhu. He was a student of religion at Temple University in Philadelphia. It's a quote from one of his essays that he went to the temple. The Hare Krishna temple was like the last thing he wanted to do. But somehow or other, one of his friends got him to go to the temple. And someone gave the lecture. He said it was the most welcome thing I'd ever heard. He spoke about how material life is miserable, and this and that, people are cheating. And he said. At last someone speaking the truth. And that changed his life. So it might be that other people, they didn't like it, or they didn't relate to it, or but one person, it changed their life. So I wrote in that essay, that we, at least for these people, we should speak. We should not fail to speak the truth. People may not like it, but for those people who are ready to hear it, and for those who are not ready to hear it, they also need to hear it. The truth is the truth, and it has its own value, which people, they can't, they don't like it because it's true. And it annoys them, but the annoyance is also, it means that we made some communication with them. They heard what we said, and it will stay with them, because no one speaks like this. It will have its effect. Whereas if we just, anyway, you can see it. Oh, eventually, when I bring out that lecture, I say if you give sugar-coated, you can give sugar-coated pills, but there has to be medicine inside. You just give sugar, that's cheating. You have to give, there must be medicine. And gradually you have to give stronger doses. If we fail to give the actual thing, then what are we doing? That's not preaching. Just bringing people and having a group photo with 500 people smiling, that's not preaching. You have to change the life. What did you want to say? Yeah, interface meeting, yeah. Well, that's a good result if they don't invite you again. Yeah. That's another point I made, that you might not meet people. In most cases, you won't even meet them again, so let them hear at least once in their life. And then they'll just forget you. Yeah, they're just... I wrote that, or you may not get another chance, but I might write that down. Let people at least once in their life hear the truth. See, I could go on writing this forever, this essay. Like that Bhaktisiddhanta book. I went on for years and years and years. There's always more things coming in. There's no end to it. What is the result of speaking strongly? Yeah, people may say, it may not be an immediate result. There's another case in there of, again, with Ravindra Saruprabhu. He brought a professor to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada just cut him up, blasted him. And the man was shouting back at Prabhupada, and then they had to remove him. And that was the professor at his university. So it was tough for him at the university. And then the professor, he in the whole university, the religion department, everywhere, he gave a very bad impression to everyone. But then later, he was actually from a Vaishnav background. So an Indian from a Vaishnav background. But later he realized Prabhupada was right. Someone else, it all comes in that essay. So one devotee mentioned that Prabhupada would have us bring all these professors, and he'd just chew them up. And every time he said, bring more professors. But he said he dealt with them differently. If they respected him, he'd still speak strongly. But if they were like puffed up, if they respected him, still he'd speak strongly. But if they were puffed up, he'd just really he'd really mangle them and really pound them, and he was very, very heavy. And they say, what is the result? Well, in the case of Prabhupada, the result is Krishna consciousness all over the world. And in many cases, the devotee told me that he heard Prabhupada, the first time he heard Prabhupada, he was speaking how the United Nations all cheating. In those days, no one said, people thought, United Nations, wonderful. He said, he never thought of that. It just amazed him. The Prabhupada just pointed that out, and that changed his life, hearing that. Many of the things that Srila Prabhupada said, he was like ahead of his time. The moonshot is all bogus. There was no one in the world. He was the only one person who would think of that at the time. And now it's become well known. At least many people accept that the so-called moonshot was bogus. There must be dozens of internet sites about all this. So many things that Prabhupada said, which people in general, they wouldn't accept at the time. I heard it said, Prabhupada said that Churchill was the biggest demon of the Second World War. And now some book got published recently. It's all research on Churchill, how he killed probably as many people as Hitler by starving people in India, by causing an artificial famine. Prabhupada spoke about that. He deliberately withheld the crops so that people in millions... And the viceroy at the time wrote to him at the time, and the only reply he got from Churchill is that why hasn't Gandhi starved yet? That's the only reply he got. He wrote, so many people are starving, and there was no need. It could have been solved very easily. There was supply of grain that could have been brought in, but he deliberately starved, literally millions of people died. So he was a big demon, and no one could imagine that at the time. Anyway, we're digressing from the subject of these questions. Fourteen, Bhagavad Gita 8:3 purport. Living entities descend in the form of rain. Then they enter the grains, and they enter the semen in a human form. Do humans evolve from plants? Well, this is for those who come from the heavenly planets, right? It's not everyone. Those come from the heavenly planets, it's stated in the Upanishads. Chandogya, is it? Is it? Yeah. This is how they come down from the heavenly planets. So not everyone. If you're coming up from the hellish planets, then you don't go that way. Do grains have life? Before we harvest them. Right? Grains individually mean, or each plant? The seeds, well, yeah, otherwise how do they grow?
When you supply the proper condition, then the soul enters. When the proper atmosphere is given to them, at that time the soul enters.
I don't know exactly how it works. Srila Prabhupada said that every cell, the soul is there, so... Then there would be one particular soul, I guess, of each rice plant, and then there would be different souls in each grain. So otherwise, how are they going to grow? That means even when they're harvested, actually, and they're dry from such grains, that if they're planted, so in one sense we say that the grains that we eat. People ask us about vegetarians, and we say they're already dead, but actually, they are living. So yeah, the soul must be there, otherwise how is the plant going to grow? Must be, right? Soul must be there in the plant. And then millions of souls ejected with each seminar discharge. Yeah, must be, at least in each cell. And with each... with each, what's that called? Sperm cell? There must be some fancy Latin name for that, I guess. In physiology, sperm cell? You just say sperm cell. Is there life in each one? Maybe not. According to, at least if we try to understand through modern science, not everyone has the potency to fertilize the ovum, isn't it? But they talk about in the modern age about sperm count. I don't know how it works. I mean, it's a subject of research. Exactly how it works, I don't know. Yeah.
I asked this question to Gopi Parana, and he said that there is a life in cells.
Yeah, just the fact that they're cells means they should be alive.
Yeah.
But whether each one is capable of evolving or mixing with the ovum and evolving into a mammal.
And it's the same like with the grain. Grain has potency to grow in the plant.
Well, it's not that every. Well, in the case of grain, if it's alive under the proper conditions, it should sprout. But not necessarily. I'm not sure. This is a scientific question, biological question. I'm not sure if, as far as I understand, not every sperm has got the potency to mix with the ovum, and then that will give rise to a child being born. I'm not sure. That's a question for the biologists to answer. Oh, it may be, yeah. That's a good point, that because of the wrong time of copulation at this time, the evening sandhya, Kashyap, he injected his semen into Diti. So the semen already, the cells were there, so life must have been there. But then particular living beings were sent to enter the womb of Diti. So how exactly it works, what is that? Karmana daiva netrena janta deho papati. Exactly how each living being gets his soul, it works according, gets his body in the material world, that works under the direction of the of one's previous activities, and it's overseen by the Supreme Lord and the demigods. Although in this case the demigods didn't know, it was a special case. It's when the darkness came from Diti's pregnancy, they didn't know what was going on. And they asked Lord Brahma, and he said, don't worry, it's a bit messy, but we know what's going on. So it's because of Diti's pregnancy. These two demons are in the womb. So in that case, they weren't sent by the demigods. They'd actually come from Vaikuntha. So that must have been arranged. Actually, it was all arranged by the Lord's Leela potency in connection with the material energy. Because they came for a purpose to interact with the Lord's, with the Lord himself, Varaha Dev and Nrisimha Dev. So that's an unusual case. But yeah, that must be there then. That would seem to be like that, that the particular soul is sent according to there are various factors, the consciousness of both the male and the female human, and the at the time of copulation, and the circumstances in which they do it. So these are all different factors by which the demigods, they send different persons to different wombs. Yeah.
Can I read just the answer? It's very interesting for Bobby Parada to
Oh, he sent you a letter?
Yeah. Semen does not live very long, even inside the body. It is produced as needed. So although semen contains a lot of jivas, they don't live there very long, a few days at most. Those who know the standards of grammatical life know that wasting semen is sinful. It is called bruna hatya, or murder of the animal.
Gopi Prandhan Prabhu, apart from being a scholar of Shastra, he's also quite learned in many other fields, so he's able to apply that knowledge of modern learning, and through the understanding of Shastra he can explain it. Not just this field, in many fields. He's really highly intelligent, obviously. He's quite learned in various fields of science, like this.
So, you know, if you accept like rain and then the grain and then person eats the grain and that gets into the semen, then this point that Garbhadhan Sanskar is important, everything gets.
Yeah, interesting, huh? Well, I guess there are different souls come in different ways. Again, karmana daiva netrena. Everything is organized by the demigod. So, garbhadhan samskar. I guess the demigods must arrange it with someone who had the grain. If that person is going to the person who has the Garbhadhan Samskara, if he's going to get a child who was previously a demigod, then the demigods must have arranged that in advance. And generally those who are coming from the heavenly planets will take birth in the higher family, Shujinam, Srimatam, Gehe, Yoga Brashto, Vijayate. So generally they will go to families in which these sanskars are performed. The sanskar also, apart from attracting good souls, it may also have the, just like the sanskars, they also help to purify the consciousness of the unborn child. It's not just for the mother and the other people, but for the child also. So, yeah, that's an interesting observation. Again, these points need more research. We need a research institute. Maybe if I say that as a, like 1,008 times. Some mystic potency. I must have said it a few hundred times by now. Some help, yeah, but we need people of very good intelligence and scholarly disposition to take this up. And even one person, how much work can they do? One man's finishing the 9-volume history, like he's spent 20 years researching the history of the big temple in Sri Rangam, the 20 years on one temple. Nine big books he's written. And there are so many things. But we need that. And there are people of Gopi Prandhan Prabhu, this kind of intelligence. But unfortunately, for years, he was not sponsored or helped. And not everyone also. There may be others who are research assistants. Not everyone's on the same level of intelligence or scholarly disposition. They can also do good work, but that's required, very much required, in many, many, many areas, actually all areas.
Just remember
They say it takes many sperms.
Yeah, it takes many sperms.
That's why they say that people have low sperm counts. But I was told that it's only one.
No, but only one.
They need someone. They need more sperms to push it in or something, is it?
The condition of the ovary is very acidic, so many sperms go. Only one survives, one or two.
Oh yeah, when they're too acidic, that's there in Ayurveda also. If the woman has too much pitta, she can't conceive. That may be one of the reasons they can't conceive. Anyway, let's not get into that too much now. You also studied medicine? Oh, I see. Just at school. Whom does the Nishkam Karma Yogi worship? Who does the Nishkam Karma Yogi worship? The demigods, and through them Vishnu, or directly Vishnu, or Brahman? Well, I don't know offhand, but I would think that it may be different for different people. I mean, you do get people who are Shaivas who are cultivating Nishkam Karma, isn't it, also? Shaivas. Yeah. Well, it may be also that they have a general sense, just like we were talking about the Kumaras. The general sense of a yogi may mean someone who has a general sense of spiritual need, but without a clear focused understanding of who the word Brahma is there. Kim tad Brahma? Arjuna asks, what is that Brahma? And Krishna, what does he reply? Aksharam Brahma Paramam. And then you may ask, well, what is Akshara? Then Arjuna himself says, Param Brahma Param Dhamma Pavitram Paramam Bhava. So Arjuna himself gives the answer to that. So, the word Brahma is generally used in, that's the word in the Upanishads. Different from the demigods, but it's generally understood impersonally. But they may, according to different conceptions, they may worship the demigods with the idea that in this way we're worshipping. By worshipping the demigods, they're symbols of the ultimate Brahman, and like this. You've heard all this. Again, it may be different in different schools. Research. Were Ravana and Hiranyakashipu also worshipping demigods with the understanding that Vishnu is the ultimate beneficiary? Well, with their understanding, it was perverted from beginning to end. I mean, the understanding that Vishnu is the ultimate beneficiary, that is based on a very clear understanding of tattva, but their whole understanding is completely messed up. So it's like even Hiranyakashipu, we find that he says that Vishnu is supreme, but he thought he wanted to kill him. So he accepted that Vishnu is supreme, but he wanted to kill him. Kamsa also accepted that Vishnu is supreme. As I know, he said he's gone and hidden in everyone's heart. People take the knowledge of Shastra, and in one sense you may say they understand it, but they get it all messed up because of their misconceptions. Just like, to give an example, there are hundreds and thousands of these, but just like someone was saying, yeah, that at the Katas, the Brahmanas, they should all dress very nicely. Because, you see, at the Samudra Mantan, the churning of the milk ocean, Vishnu was dressed very nicely, he got Lakshmi. And Shiva came looking like a beggar and he got the poison. So then you should dress nicely, with all jewels like Vishnu. So what Ravana and Hiranyakashipu's understanding was, I can't say exactly, but it was a mess. I don't think we should try to understand too much what it was. I've heard it said, I don't know if it's true because I've not had it confirmed, but many years ago I heard it said that a devotee, when Srila Prabhupada brought out this, the first part of Chaitanya Charitamrita, of his commentary, the first part that he translated was chapter 7 of Adi Lila, which is largely devoted to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's defeating the Mayavadis of Varanasi. And there's a lot of commentary in there translated from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's purports, complex discussion of Mayavad. So I heard it said, Prabhupada had first had this published as an individual book, just chapter 7. So I heard it said, the devotee said to Prabhupada, said that, Prabhupada, I can't understand this Mayavad philosophy. Prabhupada said, that's good. If you understood it, you'd be in trouble. It's not understand. It doesn't make any sense. So I heard that said. I don't know if it's true. It's quite possible. So we shouldn't worry too much what Ravana was thinking. Yeah, this Indrajit, he was doing yajnas, right? Yeah, he was the son, they were all sons. Hiranyakashipu, he was the cousin of Vishnu. Vishnu got born later. Then in one sense we're all related to Vishnu, right? We're all children of Vishnu. But he was born in the same family. Huh? Sorry? We are. We're all related to Hiranyakashipu. Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam. We're all related. Yeah, but that's why I said Indrajit, because in the battle he went away to do a yajna to get strength to fight and kill Vishnu. How about that? And in Shastra also we find all different, the Atharva Veda is full of all this, and this worshipping, making spells, abhicha is a word, Shastric word for magic, black magic. You can invoke lower forces to, it's going on in India all the time, right? People, all over the world it's going on. You invoke some lower spirits. So if not, are they in Karma Kanda? In Karma Kanda, I wouldn't say that Ravana was in Karma Kanda. He was just a demon. I mean, he may be following, in some sense, the Vedic culture, but the Vedic culture is based on Dharma. But Duryodhana may have also thought, I'm following Dharma. When he was dying, he said, see, I'm happy. I performed so many yajnas. I served so many brahmanas. And now you have to live with all your sinful reactions for having killed so many people in an adharmic way. So he thought he was dharmic, but he wasn't. So they may think that they're very pious, but they're not really within. There's no purification because they have such a demoniac attitude. We find in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says about the demons, what is that? Nama yajna istri, that they perform yajnas just in name only. They're demons, but they perform yajnas. But because their attitude is so sinful, they get the result of going to hell. So that can't be called proper karma kanda. There should be this spirit of at least that should be inculcated, this spirit of dharma, of wanting to perform activity. The whole purpose in the Vedic culture, you perform sacrifice, the idea that we recognize a higher power, and from the beginning, dharma, it inculcates the idea that we're supposed to act not only for our own benefit, but for the benefit of others. And one should perform activities for others as a duty. So if that's not there, there's not really dharma at all. That's the very beginning. We should plant trees on the road so people get shade, dig ponds and wells, public services so people can benefit. One might do that as a demon also, but just like we find in the modern politicians, they do something for the public, but their aim is to get their vote so that they can retain their position and go on totally, grossly. Their overall aim is to grossly exploit others, but they make a show of doing a few public benefits works so that people think they're good people, but they're not. So would you call a politician who gives people, children, eggs in the school and gives everyone a free TV, but the idea is they get a free TV so they watch, they have their own TV channel which they indoctrinate people to vote for them. So are they actually benefiting? It may seem that they're benefiting the people, but is it? They have a very demoniac motive behind it. Yeah. They were fighting what, sorry? They're fighting against demigods who had appeared as monkeys. Well, the Vedic process, it may give a result even to demoniac followers. Shukracharya, because the demons followed him, and when Indra, he angered Brihaspati. And then at that time, the demons were becoming very strong because they were faithfully following their guru. And Bali Maharaj, by the strength of Shukra, he got the heavenly planets. And that's why all the demons were upset with him, that he didn't follow Shukra's advice to not give charity to Vamana. And the result was, as Shukra said, he lost the heavenly planets. So, the Vedic process in itself is powerful. Maybe that's one reason why it said it should, the mantra should not be heard by Shudras or lower. Can be misused also. So the Mimamsakas, their whole understanding is based on that. You just do it and you get the result. Brahma felt that he had to give. He was in a lose-lose situation again. Tell Stephen Covey, if I don't give a benediction to Hiranyakashipu, we'll go on all these austerities. It'll cause so much disturbance to the universe. If I do give him the benediction, it'll also cause disturbance to the universe. Either way, but for immediate relief, he thought anyway. If I don't give him, he'll go on and make a worse and worse situation. Sooner or later, I'll have to. But then Rishimadev later told Brahma, don't give benedictions like that anymore. Brahma could have just killed him outright. But I guess as a Brahmana, he didn't want to do that. Though when Duryodhana was born, Vidura told Dhritarashtra, kill him, don't let him live anymore. Infanticide. Just kill him right now. And he's going to be a big problem. So there you are, there's an example of infanticide recommended. So, what else? What's the time? Past the time. Okay, I think I'll finish there. We got through most of them. I could... You see, any one of these topics we could discuss. If we can go very intricately and all these things. I guess we can do the rest in Baroda next month. You'll probably have a whole bunch more questions at that time. I didn't look at those other things you sent me. I just read this briefly once. I didn't prepare anything. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Yeah, it's a big ocean, Vedic understanding. You just get a little bit wrong and everything goes wrong. Just get it right and everything goes right. So it's important to get it right. Otherwise you end up with something which looks like the right thing, but it's the wrong thing. I'm going to talk about that in Baroda. I have one point I want to discuss about how to about consciousness raising, like in the West, this popular term, Buddhism, New Age. So I want to discuss that. In one sense, it's consciousness raising. People become vegetarians, they believe in reincarnation. And anyway, I'll discuss it. I have an idea to discuss it there.